Support for TC Jufo comes from The Ordway, presenting Fiddler on the Roof. This beloved theatrical masterpiece introduces a new generation to the powerful, heartwarming story of fathers and daughters and husbands and wives. Running from November 30th through December 12th in downtown St. Paul, tickets are available at ordway.org, and when you use our exclusive discount code TCJ at checkout between now and November 30th, you'll get 15% off your order, up to 4 tickets per account. That discount is available on tickets the first week of the run, November 30th through December 3rd and December 5th in the evening. And TC Jufolk is supported by Englander Dental and Dr. Manuel Englander. Located at 3801 West 50th Street in Edina, Dr. Englander and his caring professional dental team provide full-service dental care and transform smiles. Englander Dental specializes in everything from routine cleanings and teeth whitening to root canals, implants, and tooth replacement. For more information, go to englanderdental.com. Welcome to this week's Who the Folk podcast. I'm Lonnie Goldsmith, the editor of TC Jufolk. This week we talk to local attorney Erica Holzer. We talk about what brought her to the law, some incredible and important pro bono work that she's done recently, and being honored by the LGBT Bar Association on this week's Who the Folk podcast. Erica Holzer, welcome to the Who the Folk podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You were nominated by one of your coworkers to be on the show, which is always fun when we get nominees to join me on the podcast. You are a partner at Maslin, a law firm that, in the interest of full disclosure, is a supporter of TC Jufolk and has been for quite a while, and we very much appreciate that support.
Yes, we're proud to be supporters.
So one of the reasons that, I mean, there's a whole list of reasons why you were nominated to be on the show. So, it's pretty cool. So I wanted to start with one that I thought was, I just got to pick one thing to start with. You have given a lot of hours, hundreds each year, doing pro bono work for the Innocence Project of Minnesota. How did you get started working with that group, which is a incredibly worthy organization to be doing work for?
Yeah. Well, ever since I was a first year associate at the firm, I started doing pro bono work for all sorts of organizations. So Innocence Project, ACLU, there's connections that we have in the community to help folks who can't afford attorneys. So pro bono work has always been a large portion of my practice. The work I've done with the Innocence Project was actually related to just one case, although that case spanned for many, many years, where we helped a man named Terry Olson get released from prison. He was one of the very few people in Minnesota to ever be released through the work of the Innocence Project, and it's probably the work I might be most proud of as an attorney.
Why is it so hard, you know, to go back and, I mean, literally relitigate in a lot of ways, not just full cases, but like even elements of cases that could turn a conviction around, right? That's kind of what happens in a situation like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's probably the hardest work. It can be the most discouraging work, you know, so I'm an eternal optimist. So I think I'm probably built well for the work because it can really be disheartening, right? I mean, most cases, where there's, you know, folks that are in prison and trying to get out of prison are not successful. You asked why that is the case. I mean, there is a host of reasons why that is the case. For one, our legal system is built on finality. And so when there is a final decision, the system itself gets really anxious about, you know, overturning something that has been adjudicated as final. And then, of course, there's the political aspect of it as well, right? Like judges or other folks in the system are a little bit antsy about overturning a conviction or releasing somebody early from prison. It's just, it's something that causes some heartburn for folks.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think for the finality of our legal system, that is one of the sort of foundational principles. I think that is a good thing because, you know, there are benefits to finality, right? So if you litigate something and you get an outcome, you ought to be able to rely on the finality of that decision. You don't want to be sort of always wondering if it's going to change. I mean, that's the point of litigating something. You get a final decision. It maybe runs through appeals, but once that process is over, you should have a sense that it's done. You can close that chapter in your life and move on. So there's some benefits to finality, and I think there's so there is some good reason to not be just sort of willingly overturning decisions, you know, especially when in the criminal context. I'm not a specialist in criminal law. I'm a civil litigator, to be clear. So, but my understanding is that, you know, when you try a criminal case, there's, you know, there's a jury of your peers, and the system is just it puts a lot of stake in the outcome of that jury process, and so doesn't want to overturn it. Now, with respect to, you know, individuals, either individual judges or individual prosecutors or others in the system who might not want to allow somebody to be released, I don't know what the hesitance is there. I mean, I think, again, they don't want to second guess the work that's been done, usually years and years and years before. You know, sort of substituting their judgment for the judgment of folks that were looking at the evidence firsthand. I mean, I think there's some humility in that. At the same time, when it's clear that there's been a mistake, I wish that there was more, especially in the criminal context, when there is somebody sitting in a literal cage, a human being, that we are more open to the idea that there might have been a mistake. I mean, we know in the criminal justice system that mistakes are made and that there are innocent people in prison. So, yeah, I wish it wasn't the case.
And you know, the case of, you know, with Terry Olson's case, he was convicted of a murder that took place in 1979.
Yes.
So you're needing to go back through literally decades of, you know, of evidence where a lot of the people who might have been investigating at that time are no longer in the state, are no longer alive. They're no longer accessible in whatever way. So I think it just sort of adds to the challenge.
Well, and in Terry's case, I mean, there's lots of information online about Terry's case. I would encourage your listeners to go to Maslin.com, look up Terry Olson in the search bar, and you can read about Terry. First of all, he's an incredible person. He's one of my favorite human beings. You get really close to somebody when you represent them in that context. Mm-hmm. I'm always rooting for Terry. He's just an incredible person. But in his case, the alleged murder took place in 1979, but he was actually not, and he was interviewed at the time, and it was essentially considered a cold case. They were never able to find out how this person died. And then the victim's daughter sort of came forward, she didn't realize that the person who died was her father. She reopened the case. And so this cold case was reopened in the 2000s. And at that point, Terry was charged with the murder. And so if you can imagine, you know, all the witnesses and all the evidence was decades old at that point. And there were a litany of errors that took place in that trial. Witnesses who gave forced confessions who then recanted. I mean, the whole thing was a total mess. It's a travesty, frankly.
No question. So you said something earlier that I found really interesting in the context of this work is you're not a criminal law specialist. You're a civil litigator. How do you find your way working on a case of criminal law like this when that isn't your specialty?
Yes. So that's a great question. So, and to be clear, the work that I did for the Innocence Project was in the civil context. So we brought a habeas petition, and then I represented Terry in what's called a 1983 claim, which is a federal statute that we were operating under. So we were bringing what were essentially civil claims.
Okay.
But I owe a lot of this. I mean, the success of Terry's release is due in large part, if not exclusively, due to a former partner of mine who's now a judge. It was his case. I was the associate. He was the partner, and he is the one who is really the one who deserves, frankly, all the credit for Terry's release. I was helping him, and he is a former attorney general or associate attorney general, and so he did have a criminal law background.
Got it. Okay.
But for the folks that are listening who are attorneys who might be interested in doing work on behalf of the Innocence Project, you do not need a background in criminal law.
Well, that's good to know. Excellent. So if anybody's listening and wants to do this work, go find Erica. Yeah, she'll catch you up.
Yes, it's incredibly important work. I will say it can be disheartening. Although I will say the Innocence Project gets, as you can imagine, hundreds of emails and letters from folks in prison wanting their services. And because of, you know, their budget and staffing constraints, they can't help everybody. So another way to help the Innocence Project is to donate to the Innocence Project of Minnesota. I think now they're actually called the Innocence Project of the North. So they've combined their services with the Dakotas, I believe. But yeah, it's incredibly important work, and they need a lot of help.
Oh, no question. It's really important work, and I've seen some of it firsthand with the work when my wife was in law school at Northwestern, working with some of the there was a lot of instances of coerced confessions from the Chicago Police Department back in the late 70s and through the 80s, and their legal clinic worked on a lot of those cases. So it's really, it's important work.
Yeah. I mean, I remember learning in law school too, in my evidence class taught by Ted Samsel Jones, who's still a professor at William Mitchell, one of the best professors I ever had in law school. We spent weeks talking about false confessions, because I think there's this notion, at least I had this notion when I went to law school, that if you confess to a crime, you committed the crime. There's nobody in their right mind would confess to a crime they did not commit. And they've done scientific studies of this that show that that's actually not the case, that there are many instances in which people will confess to crimes they did not commit. It is just amazing, but it's true. It does happen.
So what led you to want to be a lawyer? Where does your interest in the law come from?
So it's interesting, because I don't have lawyers in my family other than an uncle of mine. I didn't grow up around lawyers. A lot of people enter the law that way because they've got, you know, family connections who inspired them. I graduated from college at the U, and I was in marketing. So I was
that's not close to law.
Well, I graduated with a degree in psychology, and I was deciding between becoming a therapist or going into marketing, which is like, you know, very polar opposite career choices. I decided to go into marketing, and I actually really liked it. You know, it's, I was an account manager, and so I got to work with creative folks and work with clients. I actually really liked it. But ultimately it was just not what I wanted to do with the rest of my career. And my wife, when I met her, was in law school. And she would talk about the things she was doing in law school, you know, reading these cases, and she would talk to me about these, you know, legal problems. And I was just, I don't know, it sparked an interest, and it really did inspire me to look into it. And so I started talking to lawyers about what they did for a living, and decided to take the plunge and apply to law school. It's one of those things where I look back and I'm really grateful that I found a career it utilizes my sort of natural skills. I can be helpful and of service to the community. And I find it just personally very fulfilling. So I feel very, very fortunate to have found a career that that I love so much.
That's funny because my wife would talk to me about the things she was learning in law school, and it kept me far, you know, as far away as I already, that's like as close to law school as I want to get as hearing her tell me about
it. Well, what's funny is I was just interviewing somebody yesterday I'm on the recruiting committee at my law firm, and he was saying that he loves the cold calling process. So this is where you're sitting in a group, you know, a class of 200 students, and the professor has a list of names. You don't know who is going to be called next. And the professor will say, you know, so-and-so, you know, and then call on you, and you have a back and forth sort of Socratic discussion. And he was saying how much he loved it. And I was like, yes, I loved that too. I found it exhilarating. And then I was thinking, you know, that is odd. You know, not many people, including probably many lawyers, but I think litigators are a special type of person that really do find that, you know, being on the hot seat, you know, having to think on your toes to be an exhilarating, energizing experience and not a terrifying one, which maybe other people would think.
Well, I know plenty of lawyers who have no interest in being litigators. I know lawyers who are, you know, I know people who went to law school. I don't actually know if they're officially lawyers anymore, but, you know, are sort of working like legal adjacent, but aren't practicing. Yeah. So it's interesting just that the skill sets you learn isn't just about, you're not just learning the law and how to apply it. There's other skill sets in there that can help you in whichever path you end up taking with it.
Absolutely. Well, and ultimately that is why I decided to go to law school. I wasn't 100% sure I wanted to be a lawyer, although after my first day of law school, I realized I had picked the right path. But the reason I chose law school was because I thought it would open the most amount of doors in the general direction I wanted to go. So whether it was something in politics or so my son just kicked a soccer ball into the window. I don't know if you can hear that.
Oh, I heard that. That was good. That was good.
And then my wife comes up to the window and goes, oh, sorry.
Welcome to that work at home life.
Yes, yes. Well, we're actually, we've got two kids in quarantine right now. I know. So there was a COVID exposure, and everyone is healthy and safe, but we're, you know, taking the precautions and keeping everybody home.
Good times.
Yeah.
Are they old enough to be able to get vaccinated?
Yeah. So this is the joke of the universe is that we got their vaccine scheduled for today. This was last week. And then the COVID exposure happened. And so now we are actually, I'm getting text messages from my wife right now saying with the communications with our pediatrician's office, whether we can go to get them vaccinated or not.
Well, hopefully by the time people hear this episode, your kids will at least be partway to being vaccinated.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. It's been a long, long, I should say this, you know, we feel really privileged actually, because, you know, while we do have two working parents in the household, we have, an incredible nanny who, essentially ran a homeschool in our basement for the entire school year last year. She's actually training to be a teacher. And so she turned our basement into a school and basically taught our kids to read and write. They're 7 and 5. So yeah, so we feel like we made it through the pandemic because, I mean, frankly, we are privileged enough to have a nanny, a full-time nanny. We were able to make it through pretty successfully. And there were some silver linings, I will say, like, you know, working from home and having my kids at home, I just got to see them a lot, which was, it's just, you know, I always sort of try to look for those silver linings. I will say that was one major silver lining, that I got to just see them every single day, you know, for lunch, and they would stop in to show me their schoolwork. And so I actually, you know, I will sort of miss that when everything goes back to in person full time.
Because there's a lot of horror stories, especially being at a big law firm, of the rat race of, you know, billable hours and burning the candle at both ends, and, you know, getting in early and staying really late.
I mean, I won't say that I got a lot of sleep. I mean, there's no question that it was hard. It was hard as hell. But But so it was a matter of working late into the night or waking up early and working a lot during the day. I mean, I will say the firm had a very, very busy year, which, there was so much uncertainty when everything, started unfolding. But yeah, we've managed to make it work.
And I suppose once you make partner, then how the firm does really, like, it's always good that your firm does well, but I suppose once you hit partner level, it just sort of takes on a bit of a different look.
It's interesting because, I made partner, last year and, it does change things. I wasn't sure how it would change, anything, but it does change your what you're concerned about, what keeps you up at night, where you focus. But I will say it's much better than being an associate. I like being able to give work to associates. That is a very pleasurable experience. I say that in jest, but I do like mentoring associates and giving them work and helping them grow as attorneys and people. But it's nice not to be the one who gets the assignment on a Friday at 4 p.m. and has to give up your weekend to do work.
So do you, obviously there are times where that has to happen, where you've got to be the one who gives out those assignments at 4 o'clock on a Friday.
Yeah.
But do the experiences that you had as an associate, particularly, especially as a younger associate, does that sort of inform you and in how you want to be a partner and dole out that kind of work?
It does. And I will say this though, I might not be so it's one of those things where, and I tell this to law students because I actually think that it's misguiding to give them other advice. And so, but you may ask 10 attorneys and get 10 different opinions on this. But when I talk to law students, especially, and I do a lot of talking to law students as part of my recruiting efforts, I say that, your first couple of years as a lawyer, you should work really hard. You should take those opportunities. You should cancel your weekend plans and write that memo because it will hold you in good stead. Now, there's going to be people who totally disagree with me and think that's terrible advice, but it's what I did. And so it's really the only advice I feel comfortable giving. And because it held me in good stead, because I was willing to work really hard as an associate. I was able to make partner in 7 years. I was able to work on really amazing cases for incredible clients, really complex legal issues. And so so as a partner, when I am giving these assignments to associates, I try to keep that in mind and also tell them that advice as well, that it will pay off to do good, hard work as a junior associate.
One of the other things that was mentioned when you were nominated was that you were recently named a best LGBTQ+ lawyer under 40 by the National LGBT Bar Association this year. How, I guess, gratifying is it to be recognized in that way by your peers that?
So yeah, it was incredibly gratifying to receive that award. I mean, I think the most humbling part of it was just to be a part of that group of just incredibly talented people, that to be considered among those 40 people was really inspiring and incredible. And I'm proud to be, thought of as a leader, I suppose, in the LGBTQ community. I mean, I've been out for many, many years. It's part of who I am and something I'm proud of. And so, it was a pretty cool honor.
So I'm sort of wondering how your Jewish upbringing and how you live Jewishly currently either informed or impacts how you practice law.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I mean, being Jewish is part of who I am, and I practice at a firm that was started by a group of Jews who couldn't get hired in the Twin Cities because of the rampant anti-Semitism in the 60s and 70s in Minnesota. And so I joined Maslin, not because of that fact, but because the values of Maslin in terms of, you know, client service and also just sort of looking out for each other. Like, it's hard to describe the culture at Maslin, but when I've tried to do it, it's like a family. It really is like, you know, we treat each other like family. So when somebody's going through something hard, we rally around the person and help them. We are protective of each other. We're pretty close knit. And so I think the you know, Maslin's roots as sort of a firm that was started by a group of Jewish people, you know, was attractive to me, frankly, when I was in law school and looking for a firm to sort of plant my roots.
You know, it's I did not know that history of Maslin, about it starting at a time when lawyers couldn't get hired because they were Jewish.
Yeah. So our founders, you know, these are, you know, Harvard grads, you know, United States Supreme Court clerks, on paper would have been a dream for any law firm in town to hire. And because of the anti-Semitism that was, I mean, truly just astounding back at that time, nobody would hire them. So they said, all right, we're going to start our own firm. And so they started that firm, and the firm became incredibly successful. And I think the sort of ethic of the founders and that those roots are still present in the firm today, even though most of the folks at the firm are not Jewish now. I mean, we have over 100 attorneys and, you know, hundreds of staff, and it's no longer considered a Jewish firm by any stretch. But those roots are still present. And I think, especially, you know, the leadership of the firm and the attorneys at the firm and the staff really guard that culture closely to protect it. Because as you said earlier, you know, it's, being a lawyer is not an easy way to make a living. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of hours. But I feel really fortunate to be able to do it at a place like Maslin that really sees people as full human beings, not just, you know, a line item on a billable hour spreadsheet.
Well, I think that's important. I think that's, you know, when you work as many hours as you do and, you know, put in the effort that you put in, you should hopefully, you don't have to do anything, I suppose, but you should hopefully be doing it at a place that values that.
Yes.
So that I think that does matter. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, Erica, last couple of questions for you. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Ooh, my favorite Jewish holiday by far, Yom Kippur.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, how come? It.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Kol Nidre is my favorite night and my favorite services of the year. I find it to be really comforting, and you know, I don't know. I think that's a good question. Why? I think, you know, there is something I feel on Yom Kippur. I feel really proud to be Jewish. I feel really proud that our religion, that the holiest day of our calendar year is spent, you know, in self-reflection and ownership of our faults. I just think, you know, it's something that as a society we're not trained to do. We're not trained to be self-reflective, and especially we are almost trained not to admit fault. You know, it's seen in our society as a weakness or something like that. And I am so grateful that in our religion, we just take the complete opposite approach. Now, some of us are better at it than others, you know, and I'm not saying that, and I think that probably more folks, you know, both, you know, Jews and non-Jews would benefit from more self-reflection and more atonement and more, you know, making amends and trying to repair harm that's been done. But I feel proud on Yom Kippur to be part of a religion that really lifts up that process. And I don't know, I love the music. I love, I don't know. There's just something about it that is very comforting.
Well, excellent. And what is your favorite Jewish food?
Oh gosh, my favorite Jewish food has to be noodle kugel. Does that count as a Jewish food?
For sure it does.
It's funny because, you know, when you think about like Italian cuisine or like Mexican cuisine, like there's a lot of like go-to foods. And when you think about Jewish cuisine, it's like, well, what did my mom make? You know?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. So I would say her noodle kugel is my all-time fave.
Is it the style of noodle kugel that has like the dried fruit in it? Or
so she makes it with, you know, like the Manischewitz egg noodles with raisins and like cinnamon. It's just delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is one of my wife's specialties for our breakfast.
Yes.
That is her must have.
Yes. It's a must have. It's interesting because I've thought about this. It's like, I love it so much. And maybe it's because we only eat it like once or twice a year. You know, it's not the kind of thing where you're like, oh, I'm in the mood for some noodle kugel. We're just going to whip it up on like a random Wednesday. It's really like, it's a dish that you only get to enjoy a couple times a year. Yeah,
absolutely. No, it's got to have, there's the meaning attached to it that really.
Yes.
Because it's because you have it during holidays and it evokes that memory of.
For sure.
You know, childhood and family.
It would feel wrong to like make a noodle kugel on a Tuesday, like just a random.
Random Tuesday. Yes, absolutely. That would just be, it would be weird.
It would just be like, yeah, no, there's something wrong about that. So I agree. Yes, it's a holiday food. It brings back a lot of good memories of holidays. Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, Erica Holzer, thank you so much for joining me today. It was fantastic to get to talk to you about some incredible work that you've done. And we appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Who the Folk podcast is part of the Jew Folk Podcast Network, a product of Jew Folk Inc. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for other podcast guests, please email them to me at editor@tcjewfolk.com. For our other shows, check out tcjewfolk.com/podcast.